This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, an Iraqi reporter for the Washington Post, Saif al-Din, who wrote under a pseudonym, Saleh Duhima, was shot dead in Baghdad. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 121 reporters have been killed in Iraq since the war began there in 2003, 99 of them Iraqi. Reporters and editors will tell you that no assignment is more difficult or more dangerous than Iraq. Western journalists face the possibility of kidnap. Jill Carroll's case is probably the best-known example. She was later released, but her interpreter, Alan Nwia, was shot dead in front of her. Western news organizations rely on Iraqis as drivers, interpreters, and more as reporters who conduct interviews, take photos, and write articles. Much of what we read, see, and hear about Iraq is the result of their work. Later in this hour, our political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. This week, the Republican presidential field is one smaller. Senator Sam Brownback withdrew. Is it time for other candidates to abandon the race? And if so, who? Our email address is talk@npr.org. But first, the risks to Iraqi reporters in particular. If you have questions about how they do their jobs and why, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. Bassam Sebti is an Iraqi who worked as a translator and later as a reporter for the Washington Post in Baghdad. He's now in graduate school at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia and joins us from a studio there. Bassam Sebti, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here.
I mentioned Saif al-Din and that he wrote under a pseudonym. You knew him. He was a colleague, and I know he was also a friend, and we're sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much. Saleh actually was one of the bravest Iraqi reporters that I've ever seen as I worked in Baghdad with the Washington Post. The first time I got to know Saleh was in 2004 when we hired him as a stringer and reporter for us in his hometown, Tikrit. And since then, Saleh proved that he was one of the bravest reporters, since he covered important news and he revealed hidden stories, and he chased actually hidden stories, scandals that that can never be found easily. And but he was very, very famous for his bravery in going to street fighting scenes. I remember someday back, I think in 2005, he called me while he was trying to give me an update of the clashes that happened between insurgents and Iraqi police. And I could hear the shooting as if it was like in front of me. And I said, Saleh, you should be careful. This is like it's very dangerous. And he said, now this is important. We should report on that. So, yeah.
Is it common for reporters in Iraq, for Iraqis, to use pseudonyms?
Well, it depends. It depends on the situation, depends on the danger that surrounds the Iraqi reporter, and it depends on the media outlet that they which they work for. For me, for instance, I didn't use a different name for my byline. I used my actual name because I work for a Western media, and Western media basically is not read that much.
But I know you didn't tell your neighbors or that you worked for the Washington Post.
Yes, I did not. Exactly, I did not. I did not. I just told them that I run my own business, which was an internet cafe in a remote area in Baghdad.
Because were known to be someone who worked for an American news agency, you would be regarded. Everybody in Baghdad runs, a bomb could go off any moment, but so everybody runs that risk. But nevertheless, you would have been targeted as a traitor.
Exactly. That's the thing. The problem is among insurgents and militias, there is a notion that anyone who works with any American company, media, anything, is quote unquote a traitor or an infidel someone or a spy to the infidels, quote unquote, and that was a very huge problem because it was very hard to keep it a secret at the time.
Mm-hmm. While American reporters or Western journalists in general, they might be kidnapped and held for ransom, I guess, as Jill Carroll was.
Yes.
Iraqi reporters run the risk of being just shot out of hand.
That's right. I always thought, like, when I first started as a translator and interpreter with the Washington Post, of course I went with other American reporters to several areas, and at the time, and especially when it started getting very dangerous in 2004, I always had this idea in my mind that if we fall in a trap, I would be the first to be shot. And they won't shoot or kill the American reporter because they usually bargain with the American military to release their insurgents release their detainees mm-hmm. instead in order to release the kidnapped reporter, and that's what basically happened with my friend Jill.
Mm-hmm. Your friend, you also worked with Jill Carroll.
I did work with Jill in 2003 for about 8 days. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And we became close friends since then.
Hmm. Let's turn now to Baghdad and to Adnan Ismail, who is an Iraqi reporter who works for National Public Radio News, NPR News. He joins us from our bureau in Baghdad, and it's good to have you with us today.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Let me ask you, we've been talking about how dangerous it is for, obviously, Western reporters to be seen on the streets of Baghdad. Is it getting more dangerous for Iraqi journalists to work on the streets of Baghdad?
Actually, yes, it's getting more dangerous because as you hear the reports of the news every day on a daily basis, maybe on a weekly basis, reporters, journalists, whether Iraqis, locals or foreigners are getting kidnapped or killed for many, many reasons because they are an easy target for the bad guys, whether militia or insurgents. They make easy money also for them. And especially, for example, for Iraqis, they are an easy target if foreigners are being protected by any means, bodyguards, Americans, but Iraqis are vulnerable outside in the street, no one to protect them. So this is the difficulty to work with foreigners. It means waiting your time to die. Hmm. Whenever it's going to be, no one knows.
To work in radio as a journalist, you need to use a microphone and a tape recorder to gather sound. How do you do that and not be obvious about it?
It depends on the area you are going to. It depends on the way you are using, the way you talk to people, the way you handle the issue you are talking about, because you cannot guess who's going to be the bad guy, whether you are holding a camera, you are holding a microphone, a tape recorder, or even a pen and a piece of paper if you are working for a newspaper. So you cannot tell the way you are going to be targeted. You cannot tell who's going to be the bad guy, the way you are going to be kidnapped or die. So it does not make any difference whether you're holding a camera, a tape recorder. It's only up to you, the way you act, the way you behave with people, and the way you establish your relations with others here.
We're talking with Adnan Ismail, a journalist with NPR's Baghdad Bureau. Much of the sound that you hear in our reports by Jamie Tarabay and Garrels and others from Baghdad is gathered by him and his Iraqi colleagues. Also with us is Bassam Sebti, a former translator and special correspondent for The Washington Post. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's turn to Mike, and Mike is with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi, Mike.
I'm wondering to what degree do U.S. media use the Iraqi journalists but then don't give them credit for it? You always see the U.S. media standing in Iraq or in front of a green screen, whatever they're doing, but it doesn't seem that they really give credit to the Iraqi journalists.
Bassam Sebti, is that your experience?
Yes, well, I think it depends on the media outlet. For us, for the Washington Post, I think almost all the American reporters were very fair with Iraqi reporters. When we went and covered dangerous assignments and even we wrote our own features, we had our bylines, and they gave us the right to have that. I don't know. I'm not sure there are some magazines and newspapers, especially American, who don't give the credit for reporters. But for the Washington Post, I didn't experience that.
Mm-hmm. Adnan Ismail, do you get credited in the stories that you help with?
Actually, here with NPR, the place I'm working with, yes, we're getting all the credit because they are very fair people, the way they are dealing with us, with locals, with the Iraqis. I find myself really appreciated here, highly valued by our NPR staff here. This is why I like working with them, because they are really good people, professional people.
But it sounds as if you are aware of situations where that is not the case.
Well, it depends. It depends. It depends on the place, on the situation you are in. But from my experience here in this place, they are good. They are doing their best to credit us. This is why I like working with them, and this is why I'm staying here with them. Even if I get offered any other job in another place, I would say no, because the place here is really, really good, and the people are fair. This is why you like to spend your time with.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Mike.
Great, thank you.
And Adnan, let me ask you, in the news business is called proposing a story, is called pitching a story. Do you pitch your own stories, or do you go out on assignments?
Also, it depends on the time. Sometimes you go on assignment. If, for example, your boss got something special in their minds, and sometimes, no, you pick up your own story. Whenever there is a case outside the street, whenever there is a story that you like to share others with, whenever there is something really, really important that you like others to know about, you bring up the story to your boss and you tell him, for example, this and this. What do you think? Maybe he had something else in his mind and he would change his idea and he would tell you, go ahead and do your own story. So it depends on the story itself. But we do both cases. We go on assignment outside and we do our own stories.
And briefly, we just have a few more seconds with you, but do you also lead a double life? Do you tell your friends and your neighbors what it is you do for a living?
Never, ever, because the rule here, don't tell anyone what you are doing, because the golden rule is that you don't know who's going to be the bad guy, who's going to tell about you, to the degree that even your family members keep it as a secret from them. Don't tell them, hide it, unless you trust them more than 100%.
More than 100%.
For sure, more than 100%. This is the golden rule.
Bassam Adnan Ismail, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Stay with us, Bassam Sebti. And when we come back, Ann Garrels will also join us from NPR's Bureau in Baghdad. If you'd like to talk with them about the dangers of gathering news in Baghdad, how it's done, and why, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last night in New York, six female Iraqi journalists were honored by the International Women's Media Foundation for courage in journalism. Out of concern for their safety, they asked not to be photographed, but one of the women spoke on behalf of her colleagues, all of whom work or used to work in the McClatchy Newspapers Bureau in Baghdad. I'd like to read a bit from her remarks. To be a journalist in Iraq, she said, is strewn with danger, so why continue? Why not put down my proverbial pen and sit back? It's because I'm tired of being branded a terrorist, tired that a human life lost in my country is no loss at all. This is not the future I envision for my children. They are not terrorists, and their lives are not valueless. I have pledged my life and much, much more in an effort to open a window through which the good people in the international community may look in and see us for what we are, ordinary human beings with ordinary aspirations, and not what we have been portrayed to be. You can read the rest of her statement in today's New York Times. Another Iraqi journalist is our guest today. Bassam Sebti worked as a translator and special correspondent for The Washington Post. If you have questions about what it's like to report in the line of fire, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Ann Garrels from a studio in our Baghdad bureau, senior foreign correspondent for NPR News, who's reported from Baghdad since well before the start of the war. Annie, always great to have you on the program.
I'm delighted to be with you.
You've been in Iraq, talking about this particular conflict on and off for the last 4 years. How has it changed since you how's it changed since you got there in terms of being able to work? Did you need a big staff when you got there? Were you able to get around safely?
Well, initially, I mean, first of all, under Saddam, we had minders and couldn't move around. Then for about, I'd say 9 months after the American occupation, we could go everywhere. It was the golden period. But gradually, it became more and more dangerous. The car bombs, the targeting. It's evidenced by, I initially lived in a hotel right on a street I walked around. I knew the dry cleaner. I knew the laundry. I bought my own food. I did all of that. And then that became an incredible liability. Hmm. The fact that people knew who I was, where I was, and the fact that we lived in a hotel right on the street, all of our windows were blown out with a car bomb. So we had to move back off the street into more and more secure accommodations, more and more guards, relying, as you heard earlier, more and more and more on our Iraqis.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't just walk down the street and chat to people.
Yeah, I was going to ask. We were speaking with Adnan a little bit earlier. To what degree are he and his colleagues your eyes and ears?
To a great degree. I mean, we go out, and we certainly embed with the military. And now that the military is living in these combat outposts in the communities, you actually can get out a lot more with them. Before, you were just with the Americans. Now, when you're with the military, you're actually with more and more Iraqis, Iraqi police, Iraqi soldiers, because these are joint patrols, mm-hmm. and you're seeing Iraqis in the community. So that's one. That part has improved to some degree. But just on our own, they are invaluable. They, you know, they have become great journalists.
Let's a lot of calls for both of you, so let's let some listeners ask some of the questions. Let's turn now to this is Fez. Fez with us from Chicago.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is for the Iraqi journalists, and the question is, in addition to being the eyes and the ears, in addition to doing the interviews, gathering the sounds, how much of your time do you spend educating your American counterparts on Iraqi culture? And if you have done, and just perhaps life in Iraq, and perhaps even changing their attitudes. And if you have done that, can you cite some examples? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay, thanks for the call. Bassam Septi?
Yes, actually we played a big role in telling our American colleagues about the Iraqi culture. There are areas and neighborhoods in Baghdad, for instance, that were very sensitive to go to. So before that, we would sit and talk to our American colleagues and tell them about how they should behave, whether they should shake hands or not, whether if they are offered to drink some tea, for instance, they should drink it. It's kind of like a cultural thing, and this leaves a very good impression towards the interviewee. And it makes it so much easier to build this kind of confidence and trust between the American reporter and the Iraqi person they're interviewing.
Mm-hmm. Ann Garrels, have you learned a lot from your Iraqi colleagues?
Completely. And, you know, my Iraqi colleagues basically live day and night with us for, you know, days on end, and then we'll go home. Because travel back and forth to their homes is often dangerous. So, I mean, you know, we get a 24-hour-a-day education from them about everything. We talk about everything. And, you know, and we negotiate everything. For instance, if I want to do a story, you know, they'll say to me, you can't go, Annie. Either because you're going to get killed or you're going to get me killed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we always negotiate all of these things. And you know, as my Iraqi colleague just said, and I mean, we've learned everything from them.
Let's turn now to Mike. Mike's with us from Sacramento.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
A couple of questions. One, I'm wondering if your Iraqi guests could comment on when things turn sour for these folks that are helping the American media. Has the State Department or their media employers ever asked or helped them get asylum in the United States or you know, to a neighboring country that might be neutral to take them in, to kind of shelter them? And second part for Anne is, have you ever been embedded with these mercenary groups? I guess Blackwater's the most famous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bassam Septi, I know you're currently a graduate student studying at St. Joseph's University there in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. as through the agency of a colleague there at the Washington Post.
Yeah, well, basically, we didn't ask for asylum or something like this. That never happened in our office, thankfully, let's say, because we basically were trying, like me and some other colleagues at the Post, were trying to get a higher degree. And I was basically trying to get a higher degree in Baghdad, and I didn't think of of coming to the U.S. first until someday, accidentally, I was talking to a Post reporter and a friend. Her name is Jackie Spinner. And she said, why don't you consider studying in the U.S.? And I thought it was hard at the beginning, but she helped me through her sister, who is a professor at the at St. Joseph's University in the English department. And she told me that they have a writing studies program that fit my needs. Mm-hmm. And that's how I came to the U.S. But as far as like asking for asylum, I don't think something like this occurred or happened in our office. But I heard that it happened in some other media outlets.
Ann Garrels is...
Well, it's happened to us. I mean, we had a staff member who was kidnapped this summer because he worked for us. And thanks to the embassy, we were able to get him what's called fast-tracked. For refugee status in the U.S. But the problem was he had to be interviewed in Jordan in order to get eventually to the U.S., and the Jordanians wouldn't let him and his family in. And, I mean, they were each day once he was released, the family was in, he was in shock. He had been tortured, hideously beaten. The family was terrified and terrorized. We had to get them out of the country. And, I mean, it was only thanks to NPR colleagues and my contacts that we just pulled strings. I had to talk to royal family in Jordan to get them into Jordan just to get the interview. And I can say happily now that this staff member is very, very happily in America. Hmm. But it is a rare case. I mean, we were so lucky. I don't know quite how it happened because most people can't get you can't get refugee status.
And I guess the question sort of lurking in the background is if things truly go south, are there provisions?
Well, there aren't at the moment. Even people who work for the U.S. government and the U.S. military as translators aren't getting any guarantees. I mean, the line is so long, it's ridiculous, of people who have been threatened, who have had to flee the country, who are sitting in Syria or Jordan and can't get refuge in the United States. I mean, this is it's appalling. And there are no provisions for people who work for the press. I mean, we can't make that promise. We have said, you bet we'll do everything we can, as we did in the case of this this staff member who was kidnapped this summer, and we succeeded. But there, I can't say with any assurances to the rest of my staff I can get you out.
Thanks very much for the call, Mike.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Given all of that, Bassam Sebti,
yes.
I guess the question then is, why? Why do you take the risks? Why do you accept these dangers?
Well, for me, it's a kind of like a moral thing. It's basically Iraq is my country. Iraq is not only a normal country for me. It's a country which I was like raised in, and a country that I've seen and went through kind of like suffering. And I just want to end this. I didn't expect all these things that are happening now to happen. So I decided from day one that when I worked with the Post to do my best to let the world know, hoping that there will be someone out there that would think and try to help and stop this madness that's happening in the country. And I spent days and nights. I even spent nights in the office. I didn't go back home for several days. I really did my best, and I'm sure all Iraqi reporters are doing the same for the same reason, because it's basically we are heading to danger. We are not getting away. So when you go to danger by yourself, it means that you are trying to do something.
Let's turn now to Siad. Siad's calling us from Chicago. Hello, Siad. You're on the air. We're having trouble with Siad's line, and I apologize for that. Let's turn instead this is going to be Pam. Pam's with us from Oklahoma City.
Yes, hi. My question is back on the safety issue. Like, if you don't tell your relatives what you do, and you tell them that I run an internet cafe in the north of Baghdad, and they see you on the south side asking people questions, like, how do you explain yourself?
Mm-hmm. There was an incident on television, I think, Bassam Sebti.
Yes, exactly. That happened to me. Like, it was a scary day for me that I thought that I'm not going to survive after that. It's hard. It's almost impossible to satisfy and convince everybody that I didn't work as a reporter. Someday I was having my hair cut at the barber shop, and the barber himself said that he saw me live on TV while I was asking a question in a press conference, and there were like about 20 patrons over there. I was completely shocked, and I said, but I was very like confident, and I said confidently that it wasn't me. And he said, no, but Sam, I'm sure it was you because I know you. He really he knows me because he's in my neighborhood. We've seen each other before. I used to go and have my haircut in his barbershop. And then his brother was standing next to him, and he said, I told you Bassam is not a reporter. He runs an internet cafe. And he said, but I'm sure it was you. And then he stopped immediately. He looked at me, and I didn't even ask him at the time. I wonder if he realized his mistake. And I think that's what happened. He realized that that I didn't want to let everybody know that I was a reporter and I was on TV live at that day. So I was at that day, of course, people were like all ears. They were listening and they're trying to figure out whether I was really on TV or not. And that was by itself just scary.
Pam, thanks for the call.
When the Americans have press conferences, Neil.
Yeah.
When the Americans have press conferences, in fact, often the Americans will sit on one side and the Iraqis will sit on the other, not because we wish to be separated, because the cameramen are under rules, under obligation not to do cutaways of the Iraqi journalists in the room. You know,
the cutaway
so
shot.
So that their faces will not be... That's no, right.
Yeah, so that we'll see where their faces.
I would love to add one more thing. I agree with Anne about this. And the problem, I remember at that day, it was the Iraqi state television cameraman. And I remembered very well at the day. I told him, don't focus your camera on me. I know this is an American style. I know this is a U.S. media style. But we are not... like in a normal country now. And you know, like I told him, what if someone takes a picture of you and show it on TV? What would happen to you? And he said, oh, okay, no problem. And then I just discovered the next day that the camera was on me. It's like, yeah.
Bassam Sebti worked for the Washington Post in Baghdad. Of course, NPR's Anne Garrell's also with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question from Michael in Columbus, Ohio. I was wondering if journalists and or the media outlets in Iraq are politically polarized like many are in the U.S. right now. Anne Garrels, what do you think?
Oh, enormously. I mean, each paper is run by a political organization, or most newspapers are backed by a political organization. The TV channels are, for the most part, are one party or the other. I mean... completely polarized.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Joe. Joe's with us from Framingham in Massachusetts.
Yes. One of the administration's criticisms is that we never hear the, quote, good news coming out of Iran. Or, I'm sorry, Iraq. And what could you give us some information about, is there actually no good news in that country?
Mm-hmm. Bassam Sebti, from your vantage point as an Iraqi journalist, what do you think?
I don't think there is good news. If there is good news, we wouldn't be in that position. We wouldn't read the bad news if there were good news. I think, basically, I'm going to speak now as an Iraqi citizen to tell you whether there is good news or not. I don't have electricity almost all day. Water comes every other day. And it's completely dangerous. Vast neighborhoods in Baghdad are controlled by militias and insurgents. So how I don't know how to find a good news out of this chaos.
Okay. Go ahead, Anne.
That's right. I completely agree. And I was just going to say, I think finally the administration has stopped hitting us on that one, because even they've been forced to admit that things are pretty bad. That's why we've got a surge going on.
Hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Joe.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and let's see if we can get one more caller on the line, and let's go to Justin. Justin's with us from Keene in New Hampshire.
Hello, Neil?
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi, first off, I'm a first-time caller. I love the show.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask both of your guests... How difficult is it to get a credible source in Iraq, and what are the implications for your sources if they were to be discovered that they'd helped an American reporter by giving them some information, if they were to be discovered by family or friends or neighbors?
I'm going to ask Anne Garrels to answer that in 45 seconds.
Well, you just have to be incredibly, incredibly careful. I mean, just as Iraqi reporters use pseudonyms at the, I mean, you see them cited at the end of lots of stories, but they don't often use their real names for obvious reasons. So you'll see in stories, you know, somebody will be called Abu Ali, the father of Ali. You won't give the full name in order not to put that person in danger.
Thanks very much for the call, Justin.
Thank you, Neil.
And Ann Garrels, take care of yourself, Annie.
I will. I've got a great staff.
Ann Garrels, NPR senior correspondent in Baghdad. Bassam Septi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bassam Septi, former translator and special correspondent for The Washington Post, with us today from Philadelphia. Coming up, Mitt Romney's Osama Obama, Sam Brownback's decision to pull out. Should other candidates now get out of the race? It's The Political Junkie on NPR News.